funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are the most interesting and important news stories to escape widespread attention in 2011, and how might they play into global events in 2012? As associate editor at Foreign Policy magazine, Joshua Keating has kept abreast not only of the stories that dominated international headlines all year, but also those that have remained under the radar in recent months and are unlikely to stay there. He writes about 10 of the most interesting such stories in an article called The Stories You Missed in 2011, which is currently available in the December issue of Foreign Policy. Josh, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Happy to be here.
There was lots in the news this past year about China's acquisition of a new aircraft carrier, but India is actually investing more in some areas than its neighbor. Where is that money going?
Yeah, well, India is actually now the world's largest weapons importer. According to one study, they account for about 9% of the world's international arms transfers, most of those weapons coming from Russia, and they're spending about $80 billion on military modernization programs. And what's interesting is it's not the threats that we usually associate, not just the threats we usually associate with India. It should be, the Kashmir region, border conflict with Pakistan, domestic insurgent groups. They're also looking east as well. The country is planning to spend about $45 billion over the next 20 years on new warships for its navy. And this China, by comparison, is spending only $25 billion over the same period. So this may be an indication that they are looking towards China's military buildup and trying to keep up.
Why the focus on naval power in particular?
Well, as I mentioned, I mean, they've kind of rediscovered the Indian Ocean as an area of operation, and after years of kind of concentrating and looking north as a military priority, they now see the Chinese superpower as perhaps more of a threat, and so they're looking to bulk up there.
What could spark a military confrontation between India and China?
Well, we saw a possible scenario this year in August when a unidentified Chinese warship actually confronted an Indian assault vessel near the coast of Vietnam and sort of demanded that it explain its presence in what it called Chinese waters. Now, whether this was Chinese waters is open to interpretation. It's an area claimed by Vietnam. Thankfully, that situation was resolved and, resulted in nothing more than some testy public statements from both sides. But, it's a sign that this sort of Asian seascape is getting increasingly militarized, and that's going to be a challenge for U.S. foreign policy as well. President Obama and Hillary Clinton have both made recent statements talking about what they call a strategic pivot towards East Asia, where they want East Asia to be more of a foreign policy priority for the U.S. In the coming years as opposed to the Middle East and Central Asia. And so, these are the kind of challenges that they're going to have to be looking at.
Can we assume at this point, though, that India's intentions are defensive rather than aggressive?
Well, actually, the U.S. has kind of welcomed this buildup. The Pentagon's 2010 Quadrennial Defense Review said they'd like India to take a more influential role in global affairs, possibly as a kind of balancing power for China. And so for now, yes, it seems to be mostly defensive, are most of the countries in that region, but it's definitely the increasing militarization of East Asia and South Asia are definitely stories that we're going to have to keep an eye on in the years to come.
So let's move on to number two. So much of Eastern Europe had been clamoring for Eurozone membership for the past several years. Now, not surprisingly, several of those same countries are evaluating their plans. Who had been scheduled to join the Eurozone that is now pushing back those deadlines?
Well, on January 1st of this year, January 1st, 2011, Estonia became the 17th country to adopt the euro. But it might be a while before there's a next one. Poland was due to join the eurozone in 2012, but that's been indefinitely postponed. They're now kind of downplaying how important it'll be. And several other countries, Bulgaria, Romania, Latvia, and Lithuania, have all kind of either pushed back their dates or are discussing it. Part of this is domestic considerations. There are certain economic benchmarks the countries have to meet before they're admitted to the Eurozone. But, you know, it's also they're looking at the experience of countries like Greece and Ireland and Spain and Italy, who have had less control over their own monetary policy and because they joined the Eurozone, and that many economists feel has sort of worsened the effects of the financial crisis there. And so they may be a little warier now about joining this currency union that doesn't have quite the sterling reputation it did a few years ago.
So from the perspective of existing Eurozone states, is it good or bad that new members are delaying plans or canceling plans to sign on to this shared currency?
Well, it's not good because right now what everybody's looking at is whether people still have confidence in this currency, and that's part of the reason why you know, it would be considered so disastrous for Greece, for instance, to leave the Eurozone. And so I think that, you know, this experiment is something that you know, one has been a kind of carrot they've been able to use to convince countries in Eastern Europe that have joined, such as, well, recently Estonia, but also the Czech Republic, for instance, to modernize their economic systems. And now that doesn't really exist anymore. And I think it's going to change the whole dynamic of how Western and Eastern Europe interact.
What are the economic implications for a Bulgaria or a Romania of delaying entrance into the EU in terms of just sort of what's happening domestically with their economies?
They don't see it as quite that much of a priority anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't think it'll have, you know, they don't see delaying as you know, anything really to worry about. Although most, I should mention that most of these countries officially are still planning to join the Eurozone and have target dates. So, you know, whether they meet those, we'll have to see. But, you know, Poland, for instance, has been growing at a much faster rate than many countries in Western Europe and has actually weathered the storm during the financial crisis fairly well. So, you know, they don't see the need right now to make a really big change without thinking it through fully.
Separate, Josh, from the current debt crisis and the currency problems, is there still political cachet to EU membership?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, well, we saw a story last week where Croatia was approved for a membership plan for EU membership, but Serbia was not. And, you know, this is a huge story in Serbia, which is, you know, sort of endeavored. The current government has really pushed for EU membership, and EU membership has been something that the European community has been able to use to get cooperation from Serbia in several areas, including the eventual apprehension of the suspected war criminals like Ratko Mladic. And, you know, it's been a really sort of effective means of getting Eastern European countries to modernize their economic and political systems, and mostly because, you know, these countries see joining Europe or rejoining, as they would have it, they've always considered themselves European countries, as a major priority. And you know, I think it's really, as I mentioned, going to change the way what Donald Rumsfeld once called old Europe and new Europe interact going forward.
We in Texas, I'm sure it won't surprise you, have closely followed the explosive drug wars along the northern border of Mexico. Mm-hmm. The past year, though, you write that a lot of that violence has started moving south toward and even into Central America. Why has that happened?
Right. Well, you know, it's been less noticed, but the drug mafias like the Sinaloa and Zetas cartels, which you know so well in your region, are moving south increasingly, looking for new territory and also to escape this crackdown. According to the White House list of major drug trafficking states, that list now includes every country in Central America, and 60% of the cocaine that enters the United States through Mexico now first travels through Central America. And the homicide rates are increasing in all these countries. And the effect has really been disastrous for all of them. Guatemala this year saw its worst massacre since the Civil War ended during the 90s. And, you know, large regions of that country are now effectively under the control of the Zetas. And the Guatemalan government has launched a major military offensive trying to dislodge the cartels, but has failed to expel them. And, you know, there are also widespread reports that a number of prominent Guatemalan politicians are receiving kickbacks from the gangs.
Is that southern shift an indication that, at least to a certain extent, the fight in northern Mexico against the cartels has been successful?
Well, I think it's a little soon to say that.
Yeah.
I think, you know, what always happens is these cartels look for more politically unstable regions in which to operate. And I think that, you know, whether or not, I mean, obviously the violence is still ongoing in Mexico, but they, you know, it may be even easier for them to operate with impunity in some of these smaller countries. You know, just one example of how Central America has kind of changed the game. Until now, the cocaine itself has been processed almost exclusively where it's grown, and mm-hmm. that's in South America, in countries like Peru and Colombia and Bolivia. But this year, the first cocaine processing lab ever discovered in Central America was found in Honduras. So this is a sign of just the fact that they're actually operating the processing labs there is a sign of, you know, just how much impunity they're enjoying. And a lot of these groups are establishing alliances with local gangs in these countries, too.
What kind of working relationship does the Mexican government have with other Central American states with regard to counterterrorism, counter-narcotics efforts?
Well, you know, I think they're working hard to try. I mean, obviously, you know, wherever these cartels are operating, it's still a threat to Mexico. Mm-hmm. Even if they're in Guatemala or El Salvador, it's still a problem for Mexico, just as cartels operating south of the U.S.-Mexican border is still a U.S. foreign policy priority. But, you know, obviously, the Mexican government right now definitely has its hands full with its own drug war, and so I think its resources to help combat trafficking in other countries may be limited.
In this country, when we talk about security at the Mexican border, we think only of the Mexican border with the U.S. I wonder how all of this has affected Mexico's attempts to secure its southern border.
Well, that's a good question, and there are sort of periodic reports of Mexico having trouble containing the sort of cross-border flows, both of goods and people on its southern border, and I think that's an issue we don't think about enough here.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking with Josh Keating of Foreign Policy Magazine. When you went through to make this list, I wonder how you collected submissions. Was it from reporters who were sort of out in the field that said, this has not gotten enough play this year?
Well, it's interesting. This was, in some ways, kind of the easiest year we've had doing this, just because the international news cycle, what we follow, has been so dominated by just two or three stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Arab Spring, obviously, the ongoing economic crisis in Europe, to a certain extent, the earthquake in Japan, and the beginnings of the U.S. presidential election. But other than that, you know, that there was a lot that got overlooked this year. So, you know, just sort of looking around at other regions, it wasn't that hard to pick out a few stories that really got overlooked. And, and as you mentioned up at the top of the segment, I think that often what we try to do with the segment is identify not just things that were missed this year, but things that may emerge as bigger issues in the coming year.
We will talk more about those after this break. My guest this hour is Associate Editor at Foreign Policy Magazine, Joshua E. Keating. We're talking about the stories you missed in 2011. You can read his article in the December issue of Foreign Policy. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Joshua E. Keating, Associate Editor at Foreign Policy Magazine. He has an article in the December issue called The Stories You Missed in 2011. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Josh, of all the stories in this piece, I found number four, I suppose, the most surprising, given that it's something I had just never thought about before. Camel populations are declining in Saudi Arabia. What accounts for that, and what does it mean?
Yeah, I mean, obviously most of these are pretty serious stories. We like to throw kind of one oddball one in there. You know, what happened is this year, but recently, the stock of meat-producing camels in Saudi Arabia has decreased from about 426,000 to just 260,000. And, you know, part of this is just the modernization of Saudi Arabia and its sort of transfer and the urbanization of Saudi society. But, you know, the demand is still there, and both for racing and also thousands of camels get slaughtered every year, especially during the Hajj pilgrimage. So Saudi Arabia increasingly is relying on imported camels. But, you know, the question then becomes where to get them. I mean, they're becoming less common in parts of Asia. Pakistan used to have a lot of camels, but now it's a lot fewer. And the big sort of surprise winner here has been Australia, which has the world's largest remaining population of wild camels. These aren't indigenous. They were brought there by British settlers from India in the 19th century. But, you know, obviously camels don't have quite the same significance in Australian culture. They're just considered sort of feral pests there to a large extent. But they've been a real windfall for Australian farmers who are now profiting by shipping their camels to places like Saudi Arabia.
On a somewhat more sober note, camels are considered a harbinger for famine in places like Somalia.
Yeah, it's often said that, you know, when the camels are the last animals to die, and once they start dying, it's only a matter of time before people start dying, and that was the case in the Horn of Africa this year, where we saw just a brutal famine in Somalia and some of the surrounding countries, and that was preceded by a reported mass die-off of camels.
Let's talk about U.S. immigration policy. For all its talk of reform, the Obama administration has actually expanded significantly on deportations.
Yeah, it's been interesting to watch this Republican primary and all the rhetoric on immigration, which tends to focus on, you know, who's going to build the higher fence and who's going to deport more illegal immigrants. What doesn't go discussed here is just the degree to which the deportations have been ramped up under the Obama administration. About 1.2 million people have been deported under Obama as of October, and that's compared with only about 1.5 million under the full 8 years of George W. Bush's presidency. And the administration's been cracking down on employers of illegal immigrants as well. They've investigated about twice as many businesses employing illegal immigrants. So it's just interesting to note the extent to which, you know, while the talk is who can get tough on immigration the most, they've kind of missed this sort of massive crackdown that's been happening at the same time.
Are there political motivations behind these deportations to the extent that perhaps the Obama administration wants to cultivate some goodwill with potential Republican voters?
Well, I think what they had in mind was this kind of two-pronged approach where they would crack down on illegal immigration at the same time as they kind of push for comprehensive reform in Congress and creating, you know, some kind of pathway to citizenship for people who have been in the country for years. But, you know, political realities being what they are, there hasn't been all that much progress over the last 4 years of accomplishing any kind of comprehensive reform. So, you know, what we've been seeing is a lot of stick and not so much carrot.
Hmm. What conditions lead to the deportation of undocumented immigrants? Because there have been some changes. Didn't the administration recently say that they would not focus quite so much on deporting people who were sort of not minding their own business in this country?
Right. The stat they always cite is that they've been increasingly focused on those who have criminal records, of course, other than being in the country illegally. And according to the Department of Homeland Security, these constitute about 50% of recent deportations. So they say that they're focusing more on finding out which immigrants actually pose a risk to public safety as opposed to those who are, just in this country and other than breaking the law when they enter the country have been abiding by U.S. law.
So, Josh, if you had to get out your crystal ball, I mean, how do you imagine this will change or continue over the coming year when everybody in politics is looking at the 2012 election?
Oh, well, I mean, I wouldn't imagine any kind of major progress on immigration over the next year. I think what will be interesting to see is, if Barack Obama is reelected and the kind of reelection concerns are off the table, if he can kind of take some riskier positions on issues like immigration, and that may be where we see more of a push on issues like immigration and climate change that were sort of big parts of his early rhetoric but have fallen off as the focus has all been on economic recovery.
So let's talk about Pakistan's Balochistan province, which has been the epicenter of a significant uprising as well as a brutal crackdown. What is the source of the conflict there?
Right. We don't really talk about, obviously Pakistan's in the news all the time, but we don't really talk about that much about its largest province, which covers about half of the country's land area, even though there's been a kind of significant insurgency there, which has been going on at least since 2007, but really off and on since Pakistan's independence. While most of our attention has been on the frontier region on the border of Afghanistan, Balochistan actually saw the highest number of militant attacks of any province in 2010, and that's continued in 2011. And these attacks have included the bombings of gas pipelines and the murder of some settlers from other parts of Pakistan who have moved to the region. Several prominent politicians and oil company executives have also been targeted for assassination.
And so what is Pakistan doing to try and quell the uprisings?
Well, the Pakistani state response has reportedly been quite brutal. According to Human Rights Watch, they've documented the killings of about 150 people between January and June of this year, and these are mostly young men who are active in Baluchi separatist politics, and they believe that many of these killings were carried out by Pakistani security forces. Human Rights Watch called the situation in the region an abusive free-for-all, and question whether the government is really able to control its security forces in the region. And, it's not really just a local concern. The because of the instability in Pakistan, it's been a kind of source for militants to slip in and out of Afghanistan. There's an 800-mile-long border there, and it's also provided a safe haven for drug smugglers and Iranian rebel groups. And the CIA even was believed until very recently to have been using a base in Balochistan to launch drone strikes. And of course, as with everything in Pakistan, it comes back to India as well, which and Pakistan has repeatedly accused the Indian government of funding the rebels, which India vehemently denies.
What's your take? Are these potentially valid claims?
It's hard to know, but Pakistan tends to blame quite a bit of its domestic instability on India, so I don't want to really wade into who's at fault there, but certainly it's a flashpoint, one of many in Pakistani-Indian relations.
It's so interesting that it's one step up and two steps back with those two countries. I mean, recently we heard reports that there was at least a bit of warming between the two countries with regard to trade, but it sounds like everything else continues to be very fraught.
Right, and that was kind of a rare hopeful sign, and actually another potentially underreported story this year has been the kind of thawing, at least, of trade ties between the two countries. Hopefully that's something that's going to continue.
How did global piracy change in 2011?
Well, we tend, in terms of modern piracy, we tend to focus almost solely on Somalia, and indeed it was another kind of banner year for them. There were 199 attacks off the coast of Somalia as of October. But, increasingly, piracy is not just a phenomenon for Somalia. And one region that really bears watching is West Africa, particularly the Gulf of Guinea, a very oil-rich body of water, which has seen a spike in attacks this year. And this is off the coast of countries like Benin, Nigeria, and Ghana. And, you know, that they've actually held president-to-president summits devoted to piracy this year. And what's interesting about these West African pirates is they're a little more traditional than the Somali ones. Whereas Somali pirates tend to hold ships for ransom, the West African pirates tend to go after the ship's cargo itself. So more like kind of what we traditionally think of as piracy.
Who has authority to deal with this problem when ships are in international waters? I mean, I guess this has been a source of concern for a long time, but how does that work?
Well, several international, in the case of Somalia, several international navies have intervened. Several of the EU countries have put ships in the area. The U.S. Navy, China are all kind of patrolling those waters to protect their shipping fleets. You know, because this is kind of a newer problem in West Africa, I think that, you know, a lot of these countries, it's kind of, it hasn't been quite as established who's going to deal with it. And another difference between the two regions is whereas Somali piracy is typically blamed on onshore instability and the kind of ongoing state of anarchy that we see in Somalia, you know, some of these West African countries are some of the most, particularly Ghana, is one of the most stable and peaceful countries in Africa. So I think it'll be a test for them to see if they can kind of handle this problem on their own or if more international assistance is going to be needed.
I mean, have military efforts to curb piracy been effective at all?
Well, not really. Despite all the international attention and the forces in the region, there continue to be attacks. I guess one positive effect is the Somali pirates at least have had to go much, much farther afield to conduct their attacks. It's not really in that Gulf of Aden region anymore. They've gone way deeper into the Indian Ocean, so that increases the risks for them. But they still seem to be succeeding at carrying out these attacks despite all the international attention and the ramped up military efforts.
And my understanding that piracy these days is so common that a lot of shipping companies sort of recognize that they will lose a certain percentage of cargo to piracy.
Yeah, it's sort of recognized, and there's not sort of all that much they can do about it. But it's just. You know, particularly the Gulf of Aden, which leads from the Indian Ocean into the Mediterranean and is essential for trade between Europe and East Asia. There's just really no way to go without it. Going alternate routes is just too expensive. So shipping companies have just kind of learned to live with the threat of modern piracy.
Joshua E. Keating is my guest. He's associate editor at Foreign Policy Magazine and author of the story, The Stories You Missed in 2011 in the December issue of the magazine. Join us now. We have phone lines open if you want to talk about anything that you have heard this hour. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Number 8 on the list is fascinating. Asia's new demilitarized zone, not the bitterly defended border between the Koreas, but this one between Cambodia and Thailand. Why is this territory disputed?
Yeah, it's a strange kind of century-old conflict that actually briefly turned into a shooting war this year. Cambodia and Thailand have been fighting over the ownership of this 11th century temple for years, and it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It was originally a Hindu temple. Now it's been converted to a Buddhist one. And the UN recognizes this as part of Cambodia's territory, but Thailand's never really accepted that judgment. And particularly the nationalist, the so-called Yellow Shirt movement in Thailand has been putting pressure on the government to be more aggressive in asserting its claims to the temple. And, you know, from in February this year, the two sides continually exchanged artillery fire over the area. And it's not quite clear who started it. Both countries claim the other one did. And, you know, thankfully only 28 people were killed, but thousands of civilians were displaced from the region, and the Cambodian Prime Minister described it as a war. And again, luckily, it was a very short and limited one. And eventually, the UN imposed a DMZ, a demilitarized zone, around the temple, and ordered the countries to withdraw. And this truce is now being monitored by Indonesia. Another interesting story that the Indonesia's kind of become the regional policeman there. you know, both countries are kind of continuing to argue over this. And, you know, partially what it is just a sign of sort of increasing instability in Thailand. There was the kind of the nationalist movement that supported this temple, and now tensions have abated once he was voted out and a new prime minister came in. But, you know, we've seen these sort of massive protests that have also often turned violent in recent years. There have been problems with an insurgency in South Thailand with Islamist militants who've been accused of perpetrating war crimes. So, and then of course there's the issue of the former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra, who's been kind of in exile and wanted for various crimes, but many of his supporters want him back in the country. So, you know, Thailand's been a cause for concern, and I think will continue to be in the coming year.
Any reason to fear that the conflict between Cambodia and Thailand could reignite and turn into something more than a sort of regionalized shooting?
Well, hopefully not as long as it's kind of being internationally monitored. But these are two kind of traditional rivals, and it's not, you know, this has been a kind of, this just kind of the most recent flaring of a kind of long-running Cold War between the two countries. And there's always a potential for more violence.
There have been calls for a Southeast Asian peacekeeping force. Is that a feasible strategy for the region?
There have been, and right now there are no kind of armed peacekeepers keeping this truth. And, you know, some say that ASEAN, which is Southeast Asia's regional body, should be in charge of that. And, you know, ASEAN is actually another organization that bears watching, as controversially the presidency of that group is going to be taken over by Myanmar's regime coming up. So it also bears watching as well to see, you know, to what extent this can really be a regional, an effective kind of regional police force.
My guest is Joshua E. Keating, associate editor at Foreign Policy Magazine and author of The Stories You Missed in 2011. You can read that in the December issue of Foreign Policy. We have phone lines open now. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Joshua E. Keating. He's associate editor at Foreign Policy Magazine. The December issue of the magazine features his piece, The Stories You Missed in 2011. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also reach us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go to the phones now. We have Carol on the line in Fort Worth. Hello, Carol.
Hi. If I'm looking at a current map, I show three countries on the northern border of Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan. And I just heard a news story last night that Human Rights Watch is concerned about ongoing human rights violations in Uzbekistan, and that U.S. is trying to develop some sort of a relationship with the leaders of Uzbekistan.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about these countries on the northern border of Afghanistan and what sort of future you see for Afghanistan and these countries on the north and maybe our interests with these northern borders.
Well, that's a great question, actually, and the increasingly as you know, the supply routes into Afghanistan through Pakistan have gotten more dangerous. We've seen more attacks on trucks, and also periodically, because of political disputes, the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan actually gets closed down. The U.S. has increasingly tried to focus on what it calls the Northern Distribution Network, which is this sort of far-reaching network meant and supply route to bring goods to U.S. troops in Afghanistan through Russia and Central Asia. And, you know, as you mentioned, a lot of the countries in this region, particularly Uzbekistan, just have atrocious human rights records going back for years. And well, in the case of Uzbekistan, it was after the a massacre of protesters in 2006, which the Bush administration criticized. The Uzbekistan government actually kind of expelled U.S. forces from that country, but now there's been a move on the part of this administration to reestablish ties, and you know, and a lot of that is kind of over the strong objections of human rights advocates in the U.S. But you know, as long as we need to keep supplying troops in Afghanistan, these are the kind of compromises that are going to have to be made. And you know, beyond the human rights question, these aren't particularly stable countries. There's a kind of ongoing border dispute. Well, not a, a water dispute between Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, which you know, is not the sort of issue that U.S. foreign policy may have been concerned with in the past. But because of this need for bringing supplies into Afghanistan, it's the kind of international conflict that we've found ourselves kind of increasingly embroiled in.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Email address is think@kera.org. We'll return to the phones now. This time we have Bruce on the line in Fort Worth. Hello, Bruce.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
My question is, and I understand there's a variance in speed among different ships in a convoy or in a seafaring, but why can't they convoy up nodes outside of the pirate zones and travel in a larger group, maybe even have Hellfire drones as cap cover, or maybe a World War II trick of having you know, merchant freighters actually disguise military vessels to intimidate the pirates from being able to do this piracy?
Well, frankly, it sounds like you know a lot more about this than I do. And I'd say that, you know, no matter how effective the sort of naval military strategy is to combat piracy, at least in Somalia, you know, we're always going to have the problem that there's a safe haven for these pirates on land. And, you know, I'd say that as long as we have this kind of ongoing instability in Somalia and there's sort of no central government and an ongoing state of civil war and mass poverty, that, you know, the seas around there aren't really going to be safe. And no matter how much resources we put into that conflict. But, you know, as far as the actual naval tactics go, I'm going to defer to you on that one. I'm not really an expert.
And, you know, Bruce's strategy does sound as if it might work, but it also sounds very expensive.
Yeah, for sure. And there's always a cost-benefit analysis here. You know, how much are we willing to spend on a threat like piracy, as opposed to you know, the kind of issues I was talking about at the top of the program, where if the U.S. is really going to be making this an Asian century and making the strategic pivot to East Asia, that's going to involve a lot more naval power than we've been using over the last 10 years. And the current naval strategy document's about 4 years old, and a lot of people are already saying that it's time for that to be revamped.
So ninth on your list here of missed stories for 2011 is the stalling of some nuclear non-proliferation efforts. What's gone wrong?
Well, you know, this goes back to that speech that Barack Obama made in Prague near the beginning of his presidency, where he, you know, said a lot of really impressive things about a renewed U.S. commitment to seeking a world without nuclear weapons. And we've seen some steps towards that, the main one being the ratification of the New START treaty with Russia, which aims to sort of reduce the number of nuclear arms that both countries have. And there's also, we saw the hosting of that 47-nation conference on nuclear security. But the other major part of that pledge was a major effort to secure vulnerable nuclear material, and that, unfortunately, has not been going quite as well. You know, according to a GAO report, the U.S. can't account for about 5,900 pounds of weapons-usable nuclear material.
Wow.
And this was material that the U.S. once shipped overseas to help other countries' civilian nuclear programs that, you know, now, unfortunately, we just don't really know what happened to it. And part of the problem here, again, has been goes back to Congress. You know, the House in particular has attempted for the last 2 years to cut funding to the Global Threat Reduction Initiative, which is a program meant to secure nuclear facilities, particularly in the former Soviet Union. And this is a real problem. I mean, in June there were six men arrested in Moldova who were attempting to sell a kilogram of stolen uranium for about $20 million. Hmm. And, you know, according to UN data, there have been about 500 cases of attempted cross-border smuggling of nuclear materials over the last 15 years. And there's probably many more than that that go undetected. So, you know, and there have been some other efforts. There was a bill introduced in both the House and the Senate in 2009 that would have strengthened penalties for nuclear smuggling, but that unfortunately is still stuck in committee. So this very ambitious effort to reach a world without nuclear weapons has been kind of stalled on that front.
So the crux of the problem is we think we know where it is, but we can't afford to send anybody to go confirm it.
Right. Well, there's just so much of this material, particularly since the end of the Soviet Union, that's floating around that region, and it's, you know, like any kind of illicit market, it's a phenomenal challenge to try and keep track of it. But you know, when there's no major commitment to sort of tracking down this material and beefing up border securities in these countries in the region, then that's always a just makes things that much harder.
Let's go back to the phones now. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Gary waiting on the line in Dallas. Hi, Gary.
How you doing today?
Great, thank you.
I just wanted to make, I guess, some comments, questions, and observations about the skirmish in Thailand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I found that my observation of it is Thailand's claim on the territory is partly because of us and strategic. It's all on a cliff line that borders the two countries, and there's a sheer drop-off cliff. And Thailand seems to claim the property all along that cliff. On the other side of the cliff is the notorious Plain of Jars that during the Cambodia War we beat and pounded to keep mm-hmm. them away from Thailand so we can have Thailand as a stronghold. So now I feel that Cambodia has a few temples on the lower side of the ridge that connect all this to a place called Angkor Wat. And since the end of the Khmer Rouge, Angkor Wat has become a gold mine for tourism for Cambodia. And in their quest for tourist dollars, they're staking claim on everything and trying to grab it all. Whereas strategically, I can't see where Thailand would ever give up the cliff face and allow the border that has been defensible to allow the Cambodians up onto the ridge into their own country.
What do you think about all that, Josh?
Well, I mean, that may be true, but it's also true that in 1962, the UN Court of Justice ruled on this case and awarded ownership of that temple to Cambodia, which is a judgment they actually reaffirmed this year. So, you know, as far as international law concerned, The site is part of Cambodian territory, though. Thailand still disputes that ruling.
The tourism implications are really interesting, though. That's a huge destination, I know, for a lot of Americans and a lot of Europeans as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, sort of accompanying the list in the magazine, we had a sort of sidebar with some of the other controversial cultural sites in the world. These are places on several border regions, including Kashmir and in Georgia. And it's always interesting to see when these kind of cultural sites become political flashpoints.
You have politics and religion and culture and then money, which is perhaps the greatest conflict
together,
of all.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we don't have too much time to talk about the final story. A couple of minutes here. Rwanda's wrong turn. Paul Kagame, it appears, is not truly committed to democratic reforms.
Well, Paul Kagame's government in Rwanda has been one of kind of the most touted success stories in Africa in recent years. And indeed, since the end of the genocide in the 90s, he's managed to bring a measure of political stability to the country and some steady, actually quite fast economic growth over the last 5 years. And he's gotten quite a bit of credit for it in the U.S. from people like Bill Clinton, from the current administration. He visits the U.S. frequently, but there have been some disturbing signs about his commitment to democracy. During the lead-up to last year's presidential election, he won by 93%. The vice president of a major opposition party and the editor of a critical newspaper were both murdered, and the UN demanded an investigation. And over the last 2 years, he's shut down some newspapers, he's arrested opponents, jailed opposition opponents. There have been assassination attempts against former army officials living in exile in South Africa. The British police even have warned Rwandan dissidents living in London that they may be under threat. So while there's a lot to applaud in what's happened in Rwanda in recent years, as we've seen in several places this year, it can become embarrassing when the U.S. is kind of continually supporting these countries to become more and more autocratic.
Can the U.S. afford to continue supporting him if it becomes evident that he was directly complicit, for example, in those murders?
Well, again, there's no sort of direct evidence right now. This is all, but it's definitely a pattern of abuses against Kagame's opponents. And, for now, I think the attitude's been that the good outweighs the bad, and particularly in a region where you have, the Congo and the large resistance army, which the U.S. has committed to fight this year, that they're kind of grappling for any kind of success story they can point to, and anyone who's brought stability. But, the kind of high-level plaudits that Kagame's earned this year, may come back to haunt some of his friends.
Joshua E. Keating is associate editor at Foreign Policy Magazine. His article, The Stories You Missed in 2011, is available online and also in the hard copy of the December issue. Josh, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Well, thank you, Chris. Thanks to everyone who called in.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. You can email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.